I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show. I am Dr. Carl O'Helvey, your host. My guest today, William F. Bankston, is a professor of statistics and research methods and the president of the Society for Scientific Exploration, an international group of scientists and researchers who study anomalies. Dr. Bankston has been researching anomalous healing for over 35 years and has numerous publications in scientific journals. He has also lectured widely in the United States, Canada, and Europe. His memoirs, The Energy Cure, is published by Sound True. Bill's research has produced the first successful cures of transplanted mammary cancer and methylcholanthrine-induced sarcomas in mice by energy healing techniques that he helped to develop. He has also investigated assorted correlates to the healing, such as EKG, fMRI entrainment, and geometric and micropulsation anomalies in healing space. His current research focuses on the attempt to record and store healing in both biological and physical systems and to be able to reproduce the healing effect without the healer. More information is available at http://bankstonresearch.com. I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show, Dr. Bankston, and I look forward to hearing about your research on energy healing with cancer. Now,
well, thanks for the invitation.
Well, I'm happy to reach you and be able to talk with you. In doing research on alternative health, how did you come to focus on cancer?
The way I got into this was kind of unorthodox in and of itself. And in the 1970s, I ran into a guy who was who alleged to be a psychic. And I was skeptical about psychic things, and I set about trying to design studies to make his effects go away.
Mm-hmm.
And the short version is I failed. He beat me no matter how complex the research design I devised, but he spontaneously morphed into a healer. And I had spent quite a bit of time in pain with a chronic bad back. I had given up a college swimming scholarship and all that, and I was a butterflyer, and I was just simply making it through life in pain. And when this guy morphed into a healer, after I had failed in my test to make his psychic stuff go away, I said, "Hey, put your hands on my back and fix it." He said, "How?" And I said, "I don't know. Just figure it out yourself." Mm-hmm. And he put his hands on my back, and it fixed in a few minutes. It was I haven't had a back pain since.
Wow.
And so I was left with the bizarre position of either walking away and trying to make believe it didn't happen or trying to figure out what it was. And so I started to watch healings after he morphed into being a healer, and there were some interesting patterns going on. Some things he couldn't affect very much at all, and some things he could affect very, very dramatically. And the things that he could not affect tended to be benign growths. And the things that he could affect dramatically were malignant growths. And I watched a few hundred of these cases and thought, well, if you're going to try to go from this just general practicing of watching healing to some systematic study, let's go with something that appears, at least in the real world, to have a pretty good response rate. And so I started to focus on cancer on the assumption that cancer seems to be something that's pretty responsive, at least to the kind of healing that we do. And we have the same kind of phenomenon. Cancer seems to respond pretty dramatically and quickly, and non-cancers, depends on what the condition is. Some things respond, some things not so much. So I decided to try to take this into the lab.
Mm-hmm.
And at Queens College of the City University of New York, we set up a bio lab and got some cancerous mice to try to take out any human elements involved in healing and see if we can get to the bottom of this. Set up cancer lab of mice, and we did our healing techniques. And in our healing techniques, we had folks putting their hands around cages of cancerous mice with a known outcome, very aggressive cancer. All the mice will be dead in a month. And we cured them all. And so that became a nice model. At this point, I have 16 replications of mice, and I got probably 75 studies on cancer using cell cultures and things along those lines. The answer is, it's a long-winded answer, but the way I got to cancer was simply the observation that cancer seems to be pretty responsive and other kinds of conditions are not, and we might as well do something in the lab that responds.
Right. Unfortunately, traditional medicine hasn't learned that yet. Because it's going in the opposite direction.
Oh, yeah.
Now, one out of every two people will have it in a lifetime.
Is it that high? Yeah.
Yeah. It was one out of two for men and one out of three for women, but now it's one out of two for both.
So. Yeah, it's pretty scary out there. And I suspect there's a boatload of reasons why the numbers are going up.
Right. And nutrition is one of the major ones, but the chemicals, the metals, the electromagnetic energy, I mean, our whole way of life.
I got to tell you, the electromagnetic energy is an interesting phenomenon. If you've never been in a Faraday cage is an environment, an actual physical structure that filters out all electromagnetic waves.
Oh.
And I do experiments inside of Faraday cages so that I don't have any competing electromagnetic signals. And so it's just, it produces a very clean environment. And what I think we've done, and this is just my experience, what I think we've done is it's like the old high school biology experiment. You can take a frog, put it in a pan of water, and then gradually increase the temperature of the water. Nothing happens. The frog never leaves. And it'll go to boiling temperature, and the frog will die without moving.
Really?
Because it's a gradual thing, and what we perceive is primarily contrast. So if you throw a frog into a pot of water, of boiling water, it'll try to jump out. But if you gradually increase it, it just sits there, and it doesn't even understand what's going on, and it just dies. And if you go into a Faraday cage, you go into an environment that's, I have to say it, it actually feels close to profound. Because I think, like the frog, we have increased the amount of electromagnetic pollution, and it's going up and up and up, and people are running around doing their cell phones and this and that, and they got the cell towers all over the place, and you just add one, you add one, you add one. It's like increasing the temperature of the water for the frog. Frog doesn't notice. We don't notice. But if you suddenly take away the pollution and you step inside of a Faraday cage, it's literally startling. The door shuts, you're in a place without electromagnetic pollution, and it feels like profound quiet. Even though it's not acoustically shielded, it feels profoundly quiet. You just feel like a stillness, and you can just feel parts of your body relaxing. And I don't think, I think we've done this to the environment, and we're living in this this mess soup.
Do you think that raising the consciousness, which is what Jeff and Clayton are doing, will resolve some of the issues?
I don't know.
Or,
I mean,
consciousness really is energy, right? Isn't it?
I'm sorry?
Isn't consciousness really energy?
Well, that's the motherlode question. I have a book, called The Energy Cure. The publisher gave me the title, The Energy Cure. I said, I don't think it's energy. And so I don't like the title.
Oh.
And they said, well, thanks for your input. And they did it anyway. So it was, they didn't care because everybody uses the term energy as in energy medicine and all that kind of thing. I don't think that there's any energy. The reason I say this is that it should have certain properties. The healing stuff seems to violate all the characteristics of energy. So, for example, distance. If in any form of energy that you know, I think that the strength diminishes according to a simple formula, but I start talking to you and I move away, it gets quieter and quieter. I shine a light, I move away, it gets darker and darker. That's pretty well understood. Well, that's different forms of energy. It all does the same thing. Healing doesn't seem to diminish with distance. And so if it doesn't diminish with distance, I think a reasonable question is how in heaven's name could it be energy? So I think that, I don't know if consciousness is energy. That's way past my pay grade. But I don't think healing is energy. I actually think that healing is information. Mm-hmm. And if information and energy are fungible, if one can turn into the other, like matter and energy kind of thing, you know, then they're probably cousins. I think you get more bang for the buck of thinking about healing as an informational transfer. So if you have a healer, the healer is offering, and by offering, I don't mean through the conscious mind, mm-hmm. but the healer is offering information that apparently the healee doesn't have.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think healing is driven by the healee, by the needs of the healee. And I think there is some sort of a non-conscious response to the request of the healee for a healing.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't seem to diminish with distance. And so I think you can take mm-hmm. this along. For example, we've done a whole lot of different cancers, and we've done them in the lab, and we've done them clinically. Mm-hmm. And it turns out the more aggressive the cancer, the easier it is to fix. So if you take a really slow-growing prostate cancer, for example, mm-hmm. It doesn't have much energy in it.
Right.
So it comes in with a, you know, taking baby steps, and mm-hmm. even the AMA now will say, if you have the slow-growing kind, you come in, they say, well, you know, come back in 10 years.
Right, right.
And you come back in 10 years, and they go, well, come back in 10 years. And so the thing limps in. If you treat it, it limps out. So if it takes 10 years to come, it takes 10 years to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what would be happening is you're giving the body the information to get rid of it, but the system itself doesn't have any energy in it. I think the energy comes from the body itself. I don't think it comes from the healer at all.
Oh, no,
on the other hand, you have someone with a really aggressive cancer, like an aggressive pancreatic cancer or an aggressive retinal blastoma or something along those lines, well, that's coming in like a freight train. When it's treated, it goes out like a freight train. And so I think the energy is in the disease. It's in the system. It's in the bodies. I don't think that the healer is doing anything energetically.
I developed a theory of nursing and health about 40 years ago, and I worked on it over 30 years. And I took systems theory and applied everything around the concept of energy. But as I remember, I looked at energy as information, so that the knowledge that one has is potential energy, because there's the potential for using it with other people. But then the information that you exchange with another person, I think I had as kinetic energy.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. So I used energy and information interchangeably. And it seemed to fit, because what I was trying to do was to get a theory with concepts that could then be used by the nurse in a clinical setting. And so then I used the assessing, planning, implementing, evaluating process with that theoretical framework. It's the last one on that. Was applying it to the community, because systems theory could be applied at any level,
yep.
cellular, individual, family, community, nation, world. And so the last one was community, and I applied the whole thing to an actual community and did an assessment. I actually used data from a community near where I lived. It was published in the 90s. And 3 years ago, they asked if they could make a digital version.
Oh, nice, nice. Yeah, very nice.
They did. But it's the only book that I ever published that lasted that long. So,
yeah.
But it was the information and the energy I used interchangeably.
Yeah, there may be an interchange between information and energy, but I still think the world of energy occupies a different set of rules than the world of information.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so just as you can take energy and matter are interchangeable,
right?
And matter has a boatload of energy in it, and energy can be turned into matter and vice versa. still the world of matter operates slightly differently than the world of energy. And I think there may be a transformative mechanism between information and energy, but if you're existing as energy, I think that the rules might be a little bit different. I mean, it's an interesting question. It's actually a pretty difficult problem.
So Einstein didn't know at all.
Well, I think he was the first one to say that. Within a couple of years of publishing General Relativity, he was writing his good friends. I've seen some of the letters. He was writing some good friends and saying, you know, I have some real doubts about what I created. And the problem he ran into was that he was already so famous, he couldn't even contradict himself.
Well, he was lucky because a lot of the people have waited until they died to become famous, right?
Yeah. Well, he found that to be a particularly a torturous experience because he, as a kid, he was always antagonistic to authority, and then he became the authority, and he couldn't even dump on himself.
Then, Bill, are there major points that you'd like to make about the work that you're doing now?
Well, I'm working on some interesting things. I've been at this for a long time, and I think it's reasonable. You know, state in loose propositions some things and then talk about what I'm working on. You ask, you know, why'd you work on cancer? We've done a whole boatload of different kinds of cancers at this point, and I think it's reasonably safe to say many, many, many experiments. Cancer is curable, and you may be living proof on the clinical level, but also we take it into the lab, and I'm talking about working with mice and things like that. We can cure cancer, and when it's cured for life.
And
among the interesting things is that there seems to be a memory of the whatever it is you gave to the mice, because once they're cured, they're immune for the rest of their lives to future injections of the cancer, which is pretty interesting.
Right.
So you can inject mice after they've been cured with more cancer, and nothing happens. And so once they've taken on the information to cure cancer, it seems to be, using this at least loosely, stored. We found that distance doesn't matter. We found, for example, that there's a dose response. And you know, a lot of people think of this unorthodox kinds of healing as, you know, magical. It's not magical. It's different, but it's not magical. So in the conventional world, there seems to be dose response curves. There seems to be dose response curves in healing, that there seems to be, for example, a minimum amount of treatment that's necessary in order to produce a X cure. But even that, there's wide variation among the different individuals. You certainly find that clinically, that one person gets better faster than another, but you also find that in the animal world. And it turns out the animal world exactly mirrors the human world. So you can have two mice in a cage. Being treated by the same healer. They've been given the same cancer. They're essentially identical twins to one another. They're in the same environment. And one mouse will take 2.5 times as long to get cured as its companion in the cage. When we deal with people, we tend to draw psychological conclusions from that. You know, they're not this way or not that way, or they don't have thinking right or something like that. But it turns out it's the same stuff in mice. There's a dose response, and there seems to be, you have sudden transformations in healing, which I find particularly interesting. So, for example, let's say we have mice in a cage, and they have big ulcerations and all that, and you're treating them, and it seems as if nothing is happening, nothing is happening, nothing is happening, and it also seems as if physically they look worse, and then suddenly it's all gone. And so healing doesn't seem to go in anything approaching a nice, straightforward, linear manner. And that can be troublesome a lot if you try to take that into the clinical world. If you have a human, you know, the human comes down and they're looking for a healing. There's a certain amount of kind of bias towards this is magical or this is spiritual or this is, you know, something like that. So we want immediate results. But it seems sometimes even during healing, stuff's getting worse, it's getting worse, it's getting worse, and then suddenly it's gone. That's interesting. It's easier to deal with in a lab than it is in a clinical setting, because a person comes in and says, you know, I got a lump. You're treating a lump, the lump's getting bigger, and they think it's not working. Well, in the lab, the lump gets bigger, and then it collapses. And so that's a phenomenon that I think just naturally occurs. We've attached unorthodox healing to give it some magical special qualities. And what I'm finding out is it like any other dose response curve.
I think there's so many variables with humans that it's amazing to me that they get results on anything. Because yeah. We're all so different. We're different physically, but then when you put the mental, spiritual on top of that, more and more research now is coming out on the effect of the spirit on the body. Well, forgiveness, for example. People who don't forgive, the research shows that they have anxiety, which leads to a depletion of the killer cells. You know, who would have thought something like that would happen just because you're not forgiving someone? And so there's so many things at the spiritual level that are also influencing the body. Take the nutrition. And now, you know, they're talking about the genes being turned on and off, and that's another whole area. I mean, there's just so many variables that you wonder how they can come up with anything.
Yeah, the clinical stuff is extraordinarily complex. And when I first started this a long time ago, I was first interested in the effects on people. And I watched, you know, literally hundreds of people getting cured of this and that, and some things fast and some things slow. And my frustration was I don't know how to unravel all this, which is why I went into the lab. So, you know, the person comes in and they get better. Well, was it your treatment? Was it they took a multivitamin? They ate a grapefruit. They didn't eat a grapefruit. You know, you don't know. And as you say, it's too complex. So I don't have the head or the patience to just do people. I got to take this and kind of do it in a pretty controlled environment so I can just manipulate one variable or the other.
I saw the same thing when I was doing public health nursing out in the community. I'd go into this family, black family, and the grandmother there taking care of the child. She just loved that child. She was doing everything wrong, but she loved that child, and the child was thriving.
Yep. And you don't know what, where, you know, and what would have happened otherwise. And it's really hard. It's really hard. And I admire, and I also scratch my head when I watch clinicians out there, you know, doing clinical stuff full time. And I think, oh, my heavens, they never know.
Right.
They never know. You know, was it them? Was it something else? Yeah, it's tough. And so I don't have the patience for that. I need to get in there and deal with something that's thought to be understood, and then I just add healing as a variable and see what happens.
That's probably why you have a strong statistical background.
Yeah,
and research
the statistical
methodology.
Thinking.
Right.
Yeah. So my methods and you know that's my comfort zone.
Right.
If you know humans, I get scared and I run out of the room.
Now, is there a specific healing method that you use?
Yeah, the healing method that I use was developed a long time ago with this guy who fixed my back. And I spent a number of years just hanging out with him and poking him and trying to dissect him in one way or the other, and you know, see what made him tick and what was going through his head, and I was interested in whether what he did was unique to him, or whether or not it was something that is transmissible. Could somebody else do it? And he kept insisting that he wasn't doing anything that anybody couldn't do. And so we spent quite a bit of time trying to figure out what we could do in order to reproduce what he was able to more naturally do. So he didn't have a teacher. The question was, can we take his stuff and make it a teachable kind of a process? That's really the question. We developed, I think, as far as I can tell, a reasonably unique approach to healing, and it has to do with extreme rapid imaging. And the general idea, the real short for, and I have all this, this is all published. I don't have any secrets, you know, up my sleeve or anything like that. I've got the method published. I've got techniques published. I've got training courses. I've got, you can take a workshop and do it for yourself. You know, so I don't have any, you know, I don't have this little secret stuff going on. But the very short version is this. We try to get volunteer healers, and I only work with people who are skeptics and inexperienced, mm-hmm. but we try to get folks, they make lists of things that they want. And they're very concrete things. So it's not like, I want to be happy. It's not like, I want to be healthy. Mm-hmm. I mean, it has no content. If you have bad knees and you can't run, you're not seeking health. You want to be able to run. And so we visualize that. And we have long lists of things that we want. They're very selfish. And they're very specific, and you'd be able to recognize them if you got them. So I want to be able to run where now I can't run. You know, that's different than saying I want to be healthy.
Mm-hmm.
You'll never be healthy. You'll never know how to recognize it, and you'll never have a diagnostic that says you're healthy. But if you can run, you can run. So these are, if you will, loosely testable conditions or situations that that we make lists of these things, and we make very specific images of a future event that doesn't now exist. So I'm running where I can't run. I have a car where I don't have a car, you know, something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
And we go through them the images extremely quickly. And I mean extremely quickly. You'd never believe how quick you can go. Many images per second. And we do this rapid image cycling during the course of a day. If we've got hands around the cage of mice, we're doing the rapid imaging. If we got hands on a person and we're trying to fix them, we do the imaging. If we're driving in a car, we image. And so my training and my workshops are in teaching people how to do this, and the craziest thing starts to happen. Healers, for example, who couldn't fix cancer, now are fixing cancer.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've had, I can't tell you how many people who've been healing for decades, and they're able to do this but not that.
Mm-hmm.
And they hear about this thing, and they say, well, I want to be able to do cancer too. I said, well, come on, join them up, you know. And they use this technique when they have the conditions that we seem to work well with, mm-hmm. one of them being cancer. So it's a very rapid imaging technique that's hard to learn. You know, I mean, mine's a pain. I'm told there are other healing techniques out there. You know, you just get into this state of mind and everything happens and all kinds of things. Well, they're better than me. Mine takes drill and practice.
So it's one more dimension.
Pretty interesting results.
So it's one more dimension to the, like, Reiki?
Yeah, I don't know Reiki, but the people who do Reiki, so I can only report, mm-hmm. I mean, Reiki is widely available. The Reiki people, you know, it's the same kind of thing. The Reiki people learn my stuff because Reiki apparently doesn't fix cancer.
Right, right.
I'm making this up, but mine is probably good for some things that they're not, mm-hmm. and probably vice versa. So if you were a skilled clinician, and I'm not, but if you were a skilled clinician, you'd probably want to know how to do Reiki because it's good for the, you know, whatever it's good for. And if you'd probably want to know my stuff, so if those conditions came up, you know, you could help your client.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the most interesting areas not explored at all is comparative healing techniques. So I'm told, again, I have no real experience in Reiki.
Mm-hmm.
That Reiki is good for things like pain.
Right, right.
Reiki is good for, I'm making this up, relaxation.
Mm-hmm.
But if you got a malignant tumor, that's not where you want to be.
Right.
My stuff isn't particularly relaxing.
See, I took...
And so, once again, you know, mm-hmm. it works on this but not that. So my question mm-hmm. is, and I don't have the answer, but it's just one of those things that's pretty interesting to me. What is different about Reiki versus my stuff? And so I've looked into what happens when you do my stuff, and I have EEG studies, and they're published, and I have functional MRI studies, and they're published, so I know what happens to your brain.
Mm-hmm.
I know that when you do my technique, I can put two brains at a distance into a phase lock. Now, that's interesting.
Right, right.
So I can produce when you do my image cycling, you get a particularly unique signal in the brain. It hasn't been seen before. And then I can put that into another person's brain. Now, I don't know if that has anything to do with healing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe we're looking at brains because we have toys to look at brains, but maybe healing has nothing to do with the brain. But they're brain correlate. You
right.
know, that's reasonably mm-hmm. interesting.
Well, I took Therapeutic Touch, and we were told not to use it with cancer patients because they thought, I took it from Dolores at NYU, and she said that they thought that it could cause the cancer to grow. And so we shouldn't use it for that. But I've used it for people that had a headache or, you know, retired, or it was just more wellness type things. I never tried it.
Yeah, and Therapeutic Touch, I know, comes out of Dolores Krieger, and Dolores Krieger comes out of her work with Grad and Esteboni.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And,
yeah.
And Oscar Esteboni, I know, because I was pretty good friends with Bernard Grad.
Oh, you were?
Oscar Esteboni couldn't treat cancer. In fact, he died of it.
I didn't know that.
Therapeutic Touch is the offshoot of this, so I think that's where you're getting the idea.
Mm-hmm. I didn't realize about Esteboni. I was reading all of that at that time, plus the work on that was published in Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain.
Yep.
Russians were doing a lot of work at that time with healing.
Yep. So, you know, my question is, what is therapeutic touch? How does it differ from Reiki? And why does it differ? Again, I don't know therapeutic touch or Reiki, but why is it that therapeutic touch does this but not that, and Reiki does that but not this? Mine does this but not that, you know, and like that. So I think we have a tendency to put healing into one big pot. You know, you have like conventional healing and unconventional healing, but I don't think there's anything similar at all. Now, I've done studies, for example, a boatload of studies on cancer. I'm doing one right now, actually, but a boatload of studies on cancer in vitro, where you use, what we've done is we've taken the medium in which cells are grown, and we treat the medium with the healing technique, and then we grow cancer cells in them. Now, this goes to your therapeutic touch. What we have on average is a 600% increase in cancer growth. Now, that's in vitro, in a well plate, you know, like in a test tube. But if you do it in a mouse, you get the opposite. And so what I think is going on is, again, healing is not a psychokinetic effect. Healing is a response to the need of the healee. And if you're treating cancer in a well plate or a test tube or some container, cancer is your client. And what does cancer like to do? Well, it likes to grow. And my studies indicate cancer grows. Cancer grows wildly if you treat it. But if cancer's in a body, the healing will go to the higher order need of the organism. And what I'd like to do, and I have not yet done, is get some cancer, juice it up so it's really dividing its brains out, and then inject it into a mouse. I bet it would collapse. But I haven't tested that. What I find is almost all my ideas are all wrong, which I think is a wonderfully freeing thing. And I have to test everything. So when I tell you I know I can juice cancer and make it divide very quickly, and I know I can cure it in a body. And when I think that if I juice it up and put it into a body, it should collapse. But I haven't tested it, and, and I would never believe me without testing me.
Right.
I've done hundreds and hundreds of experiments, and I'm almost always wrong, which means I don't know what I'm talking about.
So anyone can do the healing then using your healing method. They can do that.
I don't know. I actually published an article once entitled "Can Healing Be Taught?" And I didn't do that to suggest it can't, but I just said nobody's ever demonstrated that it can. There is no demonstration that healing can be taught that exists to this day. And so you have people who take training and they go out and do tests, but there's no pre-post test. So people who take my workshops can go out and cure cancer, but I don't know whether they could do it before.
Right.
And maybe I just gave them permission. I don't know. So,
well, that's another.
I only deal in my experiments.
That's another study.
Oh yeah.
They can, you take them before and see if they can heal, and then you teach them,
and then do them after and see if there's value added. When I published this, "Can Healing Be Taught?" I had people screaming in my face. They were screaming and going, you know, you're an idiot. And I said, well, that's a separate issue. and I'd say, is there a problem with my article? And they would say, yes, you're just wrong. I said, what part was I wrong in? And they'd say, I don't know, I didn't read it.
Oh.
I just know you're wrong. And I said, well, you scare me because you're a believer.
Right.
Yeah, believers scare me. And so in answer to your question, so far, I can tell you that any skeptic who's taken my workshop has been able to heal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if believers can heal.
Well, that's interesting that skeptics can.
Yeah, I only take naive people who don't know anything about healing in my experiments, and they think I'm crazy, and
mm-hmm.
sometimes they even think I'm studying to see how gullible they are. And they do wonderful things because they're not spending all their time defending beliefs. They're just doing it.
Where are you going from here in your research?
In the research right now, I actually just on this very day, I sent out an article to a traditional biology journal. And what I'm trying to do, this is the general research agenda right now, what I'm trying to do is to make healing scalable. Let's say you can learn my healing technique.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I got, you know, workshops, all that kind of stuff. You come, you take a workshop, you do it, and then even you teach your friends. Well, it turns out there's an inexhaustible supply of people in pain. You know, there's just, it's unending.
Right.
It's astonishing out there how many people are all over the place in so much need. And so even if I spent the rest of my life teaching people how to do this, and I reached hundreds and hundreds of people who now go out and do it, there's still too many people and there's too much need.
Right.
So what I'm doing right now is I'm focusing on, can I capture it, record it, and reproduce it, and thereby make it scalable. So I just finished seven experiments on this very thing. And the short version is this. Inside of a Faraday cage, we had, this is a very, very elaborate experiment. You know, very, very costly, and it's taken years to pull this off. And coincidentally, I mean, the paper just went out today. But what we have is inside of this Faraday cage, which is a electromagnetically pure place, we have 33 different kinds of detectors. And the reason we have 33 different kinds of detectors is so we can get any part of the spectrum. Inside those, I have three people who know my healing techniques practicing the healing techniques.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing the healing techniques inside the Faraday cage, and we're running 33 different kinds of recorders, which we then reduce to a stereo signal. We actually had to build a supercomputer to do this.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big database. And so we have this recording of healing intention, if you will, or healing practice inside the Faraday cage, 33 detectors. And now we've got, that was done on the West Coast, and now we move to the East Coast. And on the East Coast, we take that recording and we're playing it to cancer cells. And we're looking at the genomics of the cancer cells. So what we have is playing this recording in an incubator to cancer cells. No
mm-hmm.
humans are involved. What we've found so far in seven iterations is a number of things. One, the cancer cells in vitro, we get 68 significant genomic changes out of 167 genes tested by playing this recording, which is startling. And the changes seem to have to do with inflammation, apoptosis. And so apoptosis, programmed cell death, is upregulated. The cancer cells are knocking themselves off. There's changes in telomere length. There's some pretty interesting biological effects.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're doing now is we've done this in seven different ways and seven different replications. So at this point, we know for sure that healing intention can be recorded, it can be stored, it can be played back, and it can reproduce at least part
mm-hmm.
of actual healing done by humans.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got essentially a proof of biological activity that comes from this. You know, we have some sense about what's going on here and there and things like that. Just this week, we're starting an experiment now to see what happens when we play the recording to mice. Will the recording reproduce the cure in mice? And the general idea there would be if it does, and who knows, you know, experiments, you never
mm-hmm.
know. We'll know in a couple of months. But if it does produce the cure, then we would have it on an actual digital recording. And the digital recording would be able to be downloadable And that becomes essentially limitlessly scalable.
Mm-hmm.
And so my goal is to have a downloadable cure for stuff like cancer, Alzheimer's, and things along those lines. And that's the current focus. So even as I go around teaching some workshops, I'm also trying to make this a scalable, downloadable proposition. I think it'd be really fun to come up with a downloadable cancer cure.
Right, and it would be so important.
And I essentially want to give it away. Anybody, I got some pretty serious funders behind me, but they're not funding it to maximize profit. They're funding it to, let's do something that's interesting.
But see, there you get into the politics again. Remember, we talked about that earlier.
Yeah.
If you get too successful or by trying to help people, then, you know, you're in trouble.
You can be in trouble. Now, I'm not trying, though, going through the FDA.
No, but you're in trouble anyhow.
Yeah, when you get I'm probably successful. In trouble anyway.
Dr. Forsyth in Nevada wrote a chapter in my book on lung cancer, and the FDA and all went after him because he was so successful. He was having much higher success rate using stage 4 cancer patients and using the criteria 5-year survival than anyone else was, and it's even higher now. I mean, it's unbelievable. Because he uses all of the technology that's there. He uses the what they call the cancer sensitivity test that matches treatments to the individual's specific biology. And he just uses everything he can use. And they went after him, and he told me, he said, they can't take my license. But he said it costs a lot of money to defend myself. And, I'm sure you've seen Dr. Brzezinski.
Oh, sure.
Who they've been after for years. And you could go on and on with the names of people who have been in trouble because they were successful. So you have to be so careful because the politics get into the way.
Oh, I understand that. And that's the basis behind my sneakiness. See, Brzezinski and all those other guys are practicing medicine. I'm practicing a download.
But
once it's in the cloud, it's out there.
But if it cures,
wouldn't that be fun?
That's a no-no.
Wouldn't it be fun?
Yes, it would be.
But it would already be in the cloud.
Yep.
You can't take it back. You can't take it back.
Yeah, I like that.
I'm not making a pill.
Yeah.
I'm not selling anything.
Right, right.
I just have something in the cloud.
Yep. Yeah,
I think it'd be fun.
Yeah, it would be. Before we get to the end, I wanted you to talk also a little bit about the Society for International Exploration.
Oh, the Society for Scientific Exploration is an international group of nerds and geeks like myself, who are mostly academics, who have gotten together to look into unorthodox phenomena. And in academia, as you I'm sure are aware, academia is pretty conservative. So academics defend their own textbooks, and they pretend they know what they're talking about and all that stuff. And this Society for Scientific Exploration is a group started by some folks at some elite universities pushing 40 years ago, and they came out primarily of Stanford, Princeton, the University of Virginia, places like that, where they kind of met by happenstance and said, you know, I'm interested in this unorthodox area of research. And someone else said, yeah, I am too. And we can't talk to anybody about it. And they formed this society, Society for Scientific Exploration. And it has continued. And now it's up to 45 countries. You can join it as an academic. You can join it just as a regular person. And we have wonderful, wonderful meetings. Last year, our meeting was at Yale. This year, we're going slightly different. We're going to Las Vegas. And so we have annual meetings. We have a peer-reviewed scientific journal. We have EdScience, which is a general magazine. It's free. You can get to all this stuff at scientificexploration.org and look at a bunch of crazy nuts who are interested in some interesting things. Yeah, I actually have an article coming out in Ed Science Magazine this month, wherein I'm looking at questioning subjective states of consciousness and healing. I have some functional MRI data and EEG data that suggests that healing is more an autonomic response to need than anything like conscious intention. And I, you know, I'm not speculating and philosophizing about this. I'm doing this with pretty serious data. And so we've got a general magazine, we've got this, we've got that. And it's just, it's a great group of people if you're interested in rigorous analysis of unorthodox phenomena. So we've got folks studying UFOs, we've got folks studying healing, we've got folks studying alternative energy systems, we've got folks studying, you know, stuff that just doesn't fit into the normal mainstream of science, and we're doing it scientifically.
Sounds great.
I happen to be the president.
I saw that.
I don't know if that speaks well of the society, but it's really a fun group. And it's meetings. You're never going to see this much brain power in a room. You come out, it takes a week to come down off a meeting.
Yeah.
As folks present. This year, I'm going to be presenting the results of my mice experiments on the recording to see if I have, whether I have a downloadable cure. There'll be folks talking about remote viewing, and there'll be folks talking about alternative healing, and there'll be folks talking about, it's just a wonderful way to network with reasonably interesting people.
Right. Sounds great. Since we are getting close to the end, Bill, would you then tell us about your book? And your think you have product, but if you have any services or anything that you, beyond the books.
The book I have is getting old. I think I have to do an update. It's published in 2010, The Energy Cure, and it's published by Sounds True, but you can get it on Amazon. And I also have a hands-on healing, a training course in The Energy Cure, which is a CD set where I just lay out my healing technique. So there are folks around the world. They send me anecdotes all the time. There are folks around the world who have gotten the CDs, Hands on Healing, and they go out and they're, you know, doing the healing. It's, as a skeptic, it pains me because I can't figure out how they do this stuff. I don't have any products. If someone's interested in learning how to do this stuff and try it for yourself, you can go to my website, and I'm giving I give workshops in how to do it. I do a few a year, not that many. I'm doing one in Cincinnati in 2 weeks. I got one in Chicago in a month and a half. Omega Institute, you know, like that. But you can go to BengstonResearch.com and look up workshops, and you'd be able to find anything as it comes along.
Great. Well,
so I don't have stuff. Hopefully I'll have a cure, but that I'd like to pretty much give away.
Right. Yeah. I like that idea. I don't charge for anything I do with cancer patients or anything, because I believe that God saved my life 44 years ago to do what I'm doing.
Beautiful thing.
I try to make money for the foundation, so I took some content that I had and made a book on prevention, cancer prevention, but it also is on my website. The only advantage of having the book is that if people go to my website, I've got interviews with cancer doctors, interviews with other people, interviews with, and so they have to go back and forth to get the interviews, but, you know, it's no big deal. And it's a little easier to have it all in a book form.
Yeah. When I went out to the publisher and Sounds True for the book, The Energy Cure, they said, "Would you make this CD set?" And I said, "I don't know. Is that a good idea?" You know, and turned out to be a good idea. It's interesting. There are people who learn the techniques. Again, I don't have any secrets. They learn the techniques from the CDs. But there's also, I'm told, there's an advantage to coming live. I'm not doing this for sales, but just coming live to a workshop, and something kind of happens in the room. People report, you know, it's good to have the CDs, but it's also good to take a workshop live. I don't know. You know, again, I have this unknown how much of this stuff is actually taught and how much is this and how much is that. I don't have any truth. That's for others.
I appreciate this very much, Bill. I know it will be interesting to the listeners. Some of it may be a little beyond them, and some of it's been a little bit beyond me at points, but that's
well,
okay.
Well, most of it's beyond me, so don't worry about it.
So I appreciate it very much.
Well, thanks for the invitation.
I thank you for joining me today on the Holistic Health Show, and I hope some of the information will be useful to you. I invite you to my websites, holistichealthshow.com, where you will find all shows for the past 7 years under the blog. You will also find much of the research on natural ways to deal with cancer and other health conditions, and can sign up for my free monthly newsletter. On my website, beatlungcancer.net, you will find many of the 135 interviews from radio and television over the past 2 years about my book on treating lung cancer naturally and holistically when I was diagnosed 41 years ago next month and given 6 months to live by traditional medicine who offered chemo and surgery. This book was published in November 2012 and was a bestseller on Amazon. You will find endorsements of the book, a place to buy the book, and an earlier one from 2007 titled Healthy Holistic Aging, A Blueprint for Success. On my third website, you will find information on the Carl O'Helvey Holistic Cancer Foundation, begun last year and currently in the phase of completing the website. This site is at www.holisticcancerfoundation.com. Information on how the foundation differs from others, board members, research on holistic natural ways to deal with cancer, including mental and spiritual interventions, interviews with cancer physicians and survivors, and more. If you would like to donate to the work I am supporting, there is a tab to donate, and I can offer you a tax exemption receipt if living in the United States. I also invite you to join me on Facebook at my Facebook page, www.facebook.com/Carl Helvey. On my Holistic Health Show page at www.facebook.com/pages/Holistic Health Show, and the Carl O'Helvey Holistic Cancer Foundation page at www.facebook.com/beatlungcancernaturalalternative. On LinkedIn, I invite you to join me under my name, Dr. Carl O'Helvey. On Twitter, I invite you to join me at www.twitter.com/HolistHealthShow, HolistHealthShow. I wish you a great week, and I look forward to having you here in 2 weeks. I'm Dr. Carl O'Helvey, your host.